Members, I'm going to call the February 18th, 2021 meeting of the Taxes Committee to order. Ms. Griska, if you would please take the roll.
Marquardt.
Present.
Marquardt, present. Lislegard.
Lislegard, present.
Lislegard, present. Davids.
Davids, present.
Davids, present. Abaje.
Present.
Abaje, present. Carlson.
Carlson, present.
Carlson, present. Detmer.
Detmer, present.
Detmer, present. Garofalo. Garofalo. Gomez.
Gomez, present.
Gomez, present. Herr. Herr. Hertas. Hertas. Howard.
Present.
Howard, present. McDonald. McDonald. Miller.
Miller, present.
Miller, present. Moran.
Present.
Moran, present. Mortensen.
Mortensen, present.
Mortensen, present. Robbins.
Present.
Robbins, present. Sandell.
Present.
Sandell, present. Schultz.
Present.
Schultz, present. Stevenson.
Present.
Stevenson, present. Swazinski.
Present.
Swazinski, present. Joachim.
Present.
Joachim, present. Garofalo.
Garofalo, present.
Garofalo, present. Herr. Hertas. McDonald. We have a quorum.
Thank you, Ms. Griska. Next, we'll move to approval of the minutes. Representative Lislegard, would you like to approve the February 16th, 2021 minutes of the Taxes Committee?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lislegard moves approval of the February 16th, 2021 minutes of the Tax Committee. Are there any comments, changes? Hearing none, I'm going to ask members to briefly unmute themselves as we take the vote. All those in favor of approving those minutes, please say aye.
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 Those opposed, say nay.
No.
Oh, the motion does prevail. The minutes of the February 16, 2021 Taxes Committee are approved. Next on the agenda is House File 991. I will move to lay over House File 991 for possible inclusion into the omnibus tax bill, excuse me. And members, this is a first step. This is the governor's tax bill as part of his governor's COVID-19 recovery budget. And so this is the first step in the budget process. And next Friday, we'll get the February forecast where we'll have the final kind of budget numbers to use. And after this first step, then the House of Representatives puts their budget together and this tax committee will put its tax policy bill together. The Senate will be doing the same. We will pass these budgets and tax policies off the House floor, pass off the Senate floor, and then Governor Walz and the Senate and the House need to come to a middle ground and come up with an approved budget and with that tax policy. So, again, this is being laid over. We talked about this a couple of weeks ago. We had Commissioner Doty in here that went over a lot of provisions of the bill. And so what I'd like to do today, I'm just going to offer a few opening comments and then go to staff to give a quick overview. And then we have 26 testifiers. And I'm going to ask testifiers, as we're kind of getting ready to get to testifiers, to look at limiting your comments to 2 minutes. And we're going to have to be really pretty firm on that. So I'm going to give you some time, those who are on the testifying list, to start looking at how you can make your testimony 2 minutes. So the governor released his plan a few weeks ago, and you know, the COVID-19 recovery budget of Governor Walz certainly was one that, you know, we have to take action. We are in a time of health and economic challenges that we've probably never seen before in our state. And we know that it has hit businesses and individuals very different. The lower your income was before COVID-19, the harder you've been hit by COVID-19. We also know, while many, many businesses have been really hit hard, the area that has been hit the hardest is your hospitality and leisure areas, where we've lost about 120,000 jobs, 40-some% of the workforce in our restaurants, bars, entertainment venues, fitness centers, and so forth. And so Governor Walz's budget recognizes this, recognizes we have to take action in these areas and invest in getting our students caught up, invest in getting people and families back to work, and investing in getting our businesses and our economy back working on all cylinders. And so what we're looking at today are the tax proportions or provisions of that budget, where the governor pays for those important investments in those areas to get the state back and recovered. And so just quickly, some of the big revenue raisers in the governor's bill is the capital gains surcharge, the creation of a fifth income tax bracket, the Section 965 repatriation, which is your controlled foreign corporations, foreign profits, and bringing those back, a corporate rate tax increase, and also a cigarette excise tax increase. Those are kind of the five big revenue raisers. The biggest revenue cuts in the bill is the expansion of the 5.35% bracket and the reduction on the lower third bracket, and also the expansion of the working family credit. So with that, I am going to turn that over to staff, and I think I see Mr. Klayman or Mr. Williams may start on that. And also for testifiers, as we get going on testifying, when you get to about a minute and 45 seconds, committee administrator Nathan Jessen will put his hand up. That'll be the 15-second warning, and then I will give the two-minute stop. And then also, after each testifier, members, I'll entertain a question, maybe two, but I do want to move through this today and also hopefully give some time for members' comments at the end. But again, a couple of weeks ago, we did have a chance to, the commissioner was here and we were able to kind of go over some things. So with that, Mr. Klayman or Mr. Williams, whoever wants to begin.
Mr. Chair, I'll start.
Mr. Klayman.
I'll start the overview. We'll start here with Article 1 of House File 991. Article 1 includes the $7 million allocation for 2022. This also includes the addition for the domestic production activities deduction that was an addition under prior law. It includes the estate tax exclusion reduction down to $2.7 million. Also, the aforementioned previously taxed deferred foreign income provisions also known as actual cash repatriations from controlled foreign corporations to domestic corporations. There are also some cleanup provisions related to the international provisions from the 2019 conformity bill. And this Article 1 also includes the corporate rate increase. And then Mr. Williams is going to describe the other provisions in Article 1.
Mr. Williams.
Chair Marquardt and members, so in addition to the provisions that Mr. Clayman mentioned, Article 1 contains changes to our itemized deduction for losses. That was enacted as part of the 2019 tax bill. I would say that that itemized deduction it was drafted in a way that it seemed like it was intended to allow the same losses that were allowed under federal law prior to the TCJA. The governor's language clarifies that losses entered into for profit, but they were not associated with a trade or business do qualify for that state itemized deduction, which is the treatment they received federally prior to TCJA. That article also includes the governor's provisions on capital gains and qualified dividend taxation. Governor's proposal for adding a fifth tier to the income tax at 10.85% for married joint filers with $1 million of income and single filers with $500,000 of income. It includes the adjustments to the first and second tier bracket threshold that would subject more income to the first tier and less income to the second tier bracket. And then finally, it includes the governor's changes to the working family credit. The governor is effectively increasing the rates on the credits that will result in larger credits for credit recipients. The governor is also increasing the phase out rate on the credits, so the credit is fully phased out at the same income levels as it is under current law. And that concludes the discussion of Article 1.
Thank you very much. And who would like to do Ms. Hagler?
Mr. Chair and members, Article 2 of this bill contains the governor's recommendations for cigarette and tobacco taxes. First, this article increases by $1 the per pack tax on cigarettes and moist snuff containers from $3.04 per pack to $4.04 per pack. As it relates to vapor products, the article subjects heat devices and electronic delivery devices sold separately from nicotine solution products to the 95% wholesale excise tax on tobacco products. The article also creates a new 35% gross receipts tax on the sale of nicotine solution products and the heat devices. This tax would be imposed at the retail level when the sale is made to the customer, that acts similar to the gross receipts tax on alcoholic beverages. And lastly, it imposes new tax collection obligations on out-of-state retailers of tobacco products by requiring them to collect all taxes imposed on tobacco products. And Mr. Chair, that concludes a brief summary of Article 2, and I will move into Article 3.
So Article 3, sales and use tax. Ms. Hagler.
Mr. Chair and members, Article 3 of the bill contains two sales tax recommendations, one of which we did here in committee a few weeks ago. The first provision relates to the sales tax exemption on qualified data centers. This provision places some limitations on the amount of refund a data center may be eligible for on the purchase of exempt software, depending on when the purchases were first made. And when the data centers were established. And it kind of varies between if the data center made its first qualifying purchase 5 or more years ago, or between now and up to five years, and then going forward, the exemption is limited to 50% of the tax paid for exempt software. It's a little bit in detail, and I can answer specific questions in the interest of time. I can take those offline. The other sales tax provision in this article is the one that we heard in committee a few weeks ago, brought by Representative Hewitt. It's the provision that exempts fundraising sales by school organizations and resolves the issues from the 2019 education bill. And that's the one that we did here a few weeks ago. And that, Mr. Chair, concludes Article 3.
Thank you, Ms. Hagler. We moved to Article 4, property taxes and local government aids. Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair and members,
Mr. Swanson, we can't hear you, or I can't anyway.
How about now, Mr. Chair? Chair.
I can, but it's not very loud.
I guess I can try to lean in a little bit more if that helps.
There you go. Yeah, try to lean in as far as you could. All right. All right. We can hear you.
All right. So Article 4 contains provisions related to property taxes and local government aids. So Sections 1 through 7 and 9 through 10 allow those with individual tax identification numbers or ITINs to qualify for homestead status and property tax refunds. Sections 8 and 12 involve an issue around split classification of certain parcels that have been approved by a structure. So these sections just clarify that parcels of at least 20 acres in size that have been approved with the structure and are enrolled in the SFIA program will have 3 acres assigned to that structure when split classified, rather than using the 10-acre split that is currently in the agricultural classification statute. Finally, Section 11 of this article allows the Commissioner of Revenue to correct overpayments and underpayments of state aids under Chapter 477A if there is an error in the factors that determine the aid amounts. Mr. Chair, that concludes Article 4, and I will move on to Article 5.
Thank you, Mr. Swanson. Article 5, miscellaneous taxes and tax provisions. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair and members, Article 5 contains a few miscellaneous tax provisions. I'm just going to jump to sections 5 through 7. These sections change the definition of other iron ore.
Mr. Swanson, yeah, when you kind of move away, we don't hear you, so you just have to continue.
Real close.
Talk straight into the mic.
Mr. Chair and members, Article 5, sections 5 through 7 change the definition of other iron ore bearing materials to ensure that the products produced by the new lump ore mining process are included in the production tax. And Mr. Chair, I'm going to pass it over to Mr. Clayman for the rest of this article.
Mr. Clayman.
Mr. Chair and members, to finish out Article 5, this article includes a provision related to capping the stadium reserve account at $100 million. There's a solid waste management tax provision in here that provides parallel treatment for self haulers on construction debris to make that similar to commercial haulers. There's also a provision providing for parity in the premium taxes for surplus lines insurance, and it imposes the same rate based on whether you're buying that directly or through a broker. And then lastly, this article includes an administrative appropriation for the Department of Revenue for $2.209 million in 2022, fiscal year 2022, and $1.86 million in fiscal year 2023. And Mr. Chair, that concludes our overview of House File 991.
So thank you very much, Mr. Clayman. So thank you very much to the House research staff for that overview. So members, we are going to go to testifiers. Before we do that, the committee strongly encourages people to send in letters, just kind of with the accessibility and that being a little different. We appreciate that. So for the record, I want to list those individuals and groups who have sent in letters. So here it is, and this would also be in your virtual packets and on the Taxes Committee website. Letters from 100% Campaign, Minnesota Council of Nonprofits, Council on State Taxation, IBEW Local 292, Ebby Brown Company, Victor Obasa, Kevin Ulvake, Kim Murray, National Electrical Contractors Association, Hunger Solutions, IBEW Local 110, Jewel Labs, Minnesota Asset Building Coalition, Taxpayers Protection Alliance, Minnesota Realtors, AFSCME Council 5, and Minnesota Inter-County Association. So now I'm going to move to testifiers. Remember, please, 2 minutes. Nathan Jessen, the committee administrator, will raise his hand when you get to minute 45, and then I'm going to just going to have to stop you at 2 minutes because we've got 26 testifiers and about 70 minutes to go. And so First, what I'll do is read who's up and then who's on deck. So first will be Deb Housie and then Charles Washington on deck. So if you would please state your name for the committee and then begin your testimony. Deb Housie, please proceed.
Okay, thank you. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Deborah Housie, and I am a proud member of SEIU Healthcare Minnesota. I'm a home care worker. I'm one of over 20,000 home care workers with SEIU who care for Minnesotans across our state. We are mostly women and people of color. I'm here today in support of Governor Walz's budget and want to tell you a quick story about why it is so important that the richest Minnesotans to pay their fair share in taxes so we can find things like home care services for seniors and people with disabilities. I take care of three clients, including a wonderful woman named Polly, who is 101 years old. Late last year, both Polly and I got COVID. I was scared for what would happen to her, so I made the tough choice to move in with her while we quarantined for a few weeks to make sure she recovered. I lost money, and it wasn't without challenges, but I'm happy to say both Polly and I recovered. Home care workers are lifelines for Minnesotans to be able to stay in their homes. We've been called heroes during this pandemic, but we have struggled to get PPE, and thousands of us currently make only $13.25 an hour. Decades of underinvestment have got us to this point where people providing care during a pandemic are paid $13.25 an hour to keep fellow Minnesotans safe and healthy. $13.25. We need to stop trying to put a Band-Aid on problems. Our union recently negotiated a new contract that is a part of this budget that includes raising the pay floor to $15.25 by 2022, increasing sick time and boosting training. I am proud of our tentative agreement. While home care workers have sacrificed
so much. Ms. Housie, that's 2 minutes, please. So any last sentence there that you want to add?
Yes. I urge you to help home care workers like me by passing a budget that funds our needs and asks the richest to pay their fair share. If you do, we can make our state more healthier, work to address racial disparities, and help make sure we come out of this pandemic stronger than we were before. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions, members? Thank you. Charles Washington and then Amy Haho is on deck. Mr. Washington.
Good afternoon, Chair Mark Hoy, Vice Chair Liz Lagarde, and committee members. My name is Charles Washington, and I live in New Hope. I'm a proud skilled construction laborer and a member of LIUNA Local 563. Before I was laid off last week, I was working for the traffic division of the Minneapolis Department of Public Works for nearly 2 years. I took great pride and using my skills to fix and maintain the city's traffic signs to help keep the community safe. Last Friday, I was informed that I was being cut in part because of so many businesses and entities that have not been operating due to the pandemic. Downtown employers had people working remotely, and diners and shoppers were light even when restaurants and businesses were open. The tax revenue that the city would usually receive from those businesses has not been collected at normal levels for months, for more than a year. So while the city is falling short on its budget, I'm collateral damage, as the deficit is balanced on the backs of workers like myself. I like my work. I need to work. I also want so I can earn a full income. I need to take care of myself and my family. It's a mental struggle to figure out how to survive with my recent application for unemployment not yet having been approved. Then all of a sudden, the impacts of COVID on my work is now excuse me, I'm in the ninth year of my career as a laborer, and every couple of years, something like this happens where I lose my job when I'm in a good situation. People shouldn't be sacrificed this way. We're not just numbers on a balance sheet or on a spreadsheet. Some
minutes. Mr. Washington, that's 2 minutes. You finish up a sentence there?
I think the tax proposal by Governor Walz is a great proposal, and I think it's time for some proactivity and funding so that people like myself can work. But for the pandemic, we would be working, and it's not our fault. So I'm in support, and I think you guys should be in support.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Washington. Any questions? All right. Next up is Amy Aho and Nan Madden on deck. Ms. Aho.
Hello, Chairman
of the committee.
Thank you. Well, Chairman Court and committee members, my name is Amy Aho, and I'm a speech-language pathologist in an elementary school with the Brainerd School District. As students return to in-person learning, many are demonstrating a need for targeted services beyond the school year to regain and recoup skills in academics, social, emotional, behavioral skills, and mental health. The need to provide targeted services to students is imperative, yet costly. In order to provide these services, districts need increased funding. These services are above and beyond what districts budget for, but are needed to ensure our students are able to get back on track. In my area, broadband has been an inequitable issue, which has highlighted opportunity gaps and created achievement gaps among some of our most difficult to reach students. The lack of internet access has greatly impacted the ability for many of our students to access needed resources. Fortunately, Brainerd has been able to offer hotspots and devices to our families. This has been another unexpected cost that districts have not budgeted for. Due to safety guidelines, the district has had to create small class sizes this year. This has decreased classroom sizes from 22 to 30 students to 15 to 20 students per room. This has directly resulted in increased academic success and the ability to create stronger relationships with students and families. Teachers are able to give more specific attention to each of their students, which increases students' well-being, academic, and social-emotional success. We know smaller class sizes are better for students. This year, we have been able to live that reality and have witnessed the positive impact on our students. It is imperative that we do not return to old practices and continue to identify and implement strategies and successful practices to continue growth within our students now more than ever. Our students have so many needs. I am glad that Governor Walz has the courage to increase education funding, freeze cross subsidies, funding extended learning time and trauma-informed schools. And I support taxing the wealthiest Minnesotans so my students can get what they deserve, the world's best education. The legislature has the opportunity to make changes and improve Minnesota's education system. COVID-19 has highlighted how important equitable education is to Minnesotans. It is time to commit to focusing on improving Minnesota's education system. There is no better time than the present. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Ms. Aho? All right. Thank you. Next up is Nat Madden, and then Dominic McQuarrie is on deck. So, Ms. Madden, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for the opportunity to testify today. I am Nan Madden. I'm director of the Minnesota Budget Project. Since the start of the pandemic and the economic downturn, we have called on Minnesota policymakers to take bold action so all Minnesotans can be safe, healthy, and economically secure. That means addressing current challenges and tackling areas of disinvestment and disparities that the pandemic has amplified, from the shortage of affordable housing to the need for childcare, to the barriers limiting opportunities for Minnesotans of color. The impact of this recession has been extremely uneven. Those with the least resources have been hardest hit, and hardship remains high. In contrast, higher wage jobs have largely recovered, and many of those with the most resources have benefited from strong stock market gains. Under Governor Walz's budget, those with the greatest resources would contribute a bit more to get through today's challenges and build a stronger, more equitable recovery. I'd like to highlight a few provisions in particular. First, the proposed income tax increased on the highest income Minnesotans. This is a strategy Minnesota has successfully used before. In 2013, Minnesota passed a fourth tier and a progressive tax package that ended a decade of frequent budget deficits and funded investments in education. And despite some concerns, the number of high-income taxpayers in Minnesota today is higher than before the fourth tier was enacted. Secondly, the governor's plan would roll back the most recent tax cut to the estate tax while maintaining exemptions for some family-owned businesses and farms. The estate tax is Minnesota's most progressive tax and it impacts only a very small number of the largest estates. And finally, we support the proposal to expand the working family credit. Many of those who would benefit are the essential workers we've all counted on more than ever during this pandemic. Thank you.
Ms. Madden, thank you very much. Any questions for Ms. Madden? Okay, next up is Dominic McQuarrie and Dr. Ryan Grenier is on deck.
Sure.
Please proceed. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Chair Marquardt, members of the Tax Committee, thanks for the opportunity to testify and happy Black History Month. For the record, my name is Dominic McQuarrie. I'm the Director of Public Policy and Community Relations at the Amherst H. Wilder Foundation and a member of the Together We Rise campaign. I'm here to speak in favor of the Working Family Credit expansion and the governor's approach to calling on those with the most resources to pay more and fund needed investments for our state. At Wilder, our mission is to promote the social welfare of persons resident or located in the greater St. Paul metropolitan area by all appropriate means. And historically, those means have not meant a lot of time in the Tax Committee. Basically, we've worked on the Working Family Credit and the Provider Tax in 2019. Our support of maintaining the provider tax is actually a great analog for why I'm here speaking in favor of these provisions today. The impacts and decisions made in this committee reverberate across every other committee in the lives of Minnesotans. It's clear that COVID has brought more attention to issues like our affordable housing crisis or the cycles of paycheck to paycheck that families see themselves stuck in every day. But these issues and these cycles are not new. They predated COVID, and without action, they'll be around long after. What COVID did prove again, though, is that when things go really bad, it's the same communities that suffer over and over again. BIPOC, LGBTQ, immigrant communities, people with disability, rural communities, vulnerable older adults always suffer the most. And I'll be honest, for our organization, settling in a position calling for no cuts and more investments would be a more comfortable place to be, but it's also disingenuous. The money has to come from somewhere, and it makes sense in an era of growing income inequality and wealth inequality that those who can afford to pay more should pay more. At Wilder, we conduct a triannual survey, and in 2018, it showed a 10% increase in homelessness. That was before the spike of what we saw in our state this past spring and summer. We see growing rates of food insecurity, substance use and abuse, child care shortages, the list goes on and on. So when we see an increased need to respond to the challenges of today and grapple with the fact that we had growing issues yesterday, we must
take Mr. McQuarrie, 2 minutes.
So in closing, we support the Together We Rise campaign and the approach that underpins the governor's tax proposals that call on the wealthiest and highest owning Minnesotans to help shake up the status quo of the way that we invest in Minnesota's future. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I want to announce that a while back, Representative Hertas joined the meeting. So wanted to get that in. Next up is Dr. Ryan Grenier, and Beth Cadoon is on deck. So, Dr. Grenier.
Good afternoon. My name is Dr. Ryan Grenier. I'm here as a physician representing my professional views, and specifically, I'm here to strongly support the proposed tobacco tax increase included in the governor's budget. I'm a former smoker. I quit over 10 years ago, but I've experienced what tobacco addiction is like. And one thing that I know is that the longer it goes on, the harder it becomes to stop, and the consequences add up. Heart attack, stroke, chronic lung disease, disability, cancer, the list goes on. Every day I see the heartbreaking and preventable effects of smoking. And each year in Minnesota, 6,000 people die from smoking, and we lose $3 billion in healthcare costs. And that's B, as in billion. And worse yet, at the moment, we're in the middle of a deadly pandemic that's seeing smokers have worse outcomes if they get infected. But every time the price of cigarettes goes up, people quit. Good science has proven this over and over. And more than any other individual factor, price hikes encourage smokers to look for help. And high tobacco prices are also a preventative factor for youth. And this is a critical point because if no one starts, smoking stops. Including e-cigarette devices with the proposed increase is smart. E-cigarettes are not approved for tobacco cessation by the FDA, which means there is not good science behind it as a cessation tool. And perhaps more importantly, more than any other individual tobacco product, These devices attract and introduce kids to nicotine, which is the source of the addiction. Smart policy would also couple the tobacco tax increase with new revenue dedicated toward community-tailored interventions on tobacco prevention and treatment. For my part, I quit smoking over 10 years ago. The price mattered and my ability to do that. And thank goodness there were people out there standing up to the industry and fighting this fight back then, because frankly, it saved my life. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Doctor. Any questions? All right. Next is Beth Cadoon, and Jill Larson is on deck. So, Ms. Cadoon, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Beth Cadoon, representing the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. The message from our members is clear. A top priority for this session should be on Minnesota's economic recovery. This includes a do-no-harm approach, which is critically important so that additional cost burdens are not placed on employers who are doing their best to keep their doors open and people employed. We strongly oppose the governor's tax proposals as they impose permanent, uncompetitive tax hikes of nearly $1.9 billion that would fall greatly on private sector employers while they continue to grapple with the impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic and its uncertainty. Many of these taxes are regressive, extremely volatile, and will greatly harm Minnesota's business climate and economic growth by undermining investment, entrepreneurship, talent recruitment and retention, the very items needed for economic growth. Minnesota is already known as a high cost state, and this will worsen our competitiveness. We strongly oppose the new fifth tier rate, bringing Minnesota's top rate to the third highest in the nation, just behind California and Hawaii. This tax increase would hit many businesses, as most businesses pay their taxes through the individual income tax. And this will reduce dollars that are used by businesses to reinvest in their companies and employees. This also harms talent recruitment and retention. We oppose the corporate tax rate increase. There are over 34,000 corporate taxpayers, and this will hit a lot of small and mid-sized businesses that will pay the top rate in the nation. A 2018 study from the Federal Reserve in DC found that for every 1% increase in the corporate tax rate, employment in startup firms declined by 3.7%. We oppose the capital gains surcharge, which would bring Minnesota's rate to the highest in the nation, negatively impacting investment and attraction of capital and harming many small businesses and farmers. The two changes on foreign income and qualified data centers are greatly troubling as they put into question the stability and reliability of Minnesota's tax laws. The foreign income provisions also have grave constitutional issues. I have written comments with more detail. Thank you for your attention to our concerns. We urge you to do no harm to our state's private sector employers. Instead, focus on how to help speed our economic recovery. Thank you.
Ms. Cadoon, thank you very much. Any questions? All right, next up is Jill Larson on deck, Gay Canseco. So, Ms. Larson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am Jill Larson with the Minnesota Business Partnership. In addition to my comments today, I have submitted written testimony. Thanks for the opportunity to provide some comments on the governor's tax proposals. This bill proposes large tax increases at a time when Minnesota businesses and individuals already pay some of the highest taxes in the country. As was mentioned by Ms. Cadoon, the personal income tax increase would give us the third highest rate in the country, and that does make it difficult to recruit talent to Minnesota. As you'll recall, the federal TCJA law limited the state and local tax deduction, making state income tax rates even more relevant as Minnesota competes with other states as a place for high wage earners. Businesses and jobs have become highly mobile and are leaving high tax, high cost states. The COVID pandemic has significantly accelerated the trend toward working remotely, and employees can do so from other states. The number of executives that we are hearing about who are choosing to move from Minnesota is increasing, and raising the personal income tax will only hasten that movement. Minnesota risks losing businesses and employees who can work remotely from other lower cost states. Raising corporate taxes is regressive, it's uncompetitive. Retroactively taxing income earned outside the US will make Minnesota's tax system more regressive, make Minnesota companies less competitive, and due to likely constitutional challenges, create fiscal instability for the state. Minnesota has a long history of primarily only taxing income earned in the U.S. The foreign income provisions in the proposal are a significant departure from Minnesota's and other states' tax policies, and it will result in large retroactive tax increases on Minnesota companies. That'll hurt their ability to compete with foreign companies. Regarding the data center issue, the state should honor the agreements it made with businesses that have invested literally billions of dollars in qualified data centers. They made those decisions to locate here because of the sales tax exemption. Deed has actually marketed the exemption across the country, and now the governor is proposing to renege on those agreements. So I know I've used up my time, Mr. Chairman. Be happy to answer questions, and there's more details in my written comments. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Larson. Any questions for Ms. Larson? All right. Gay Canseco is now up, and Jessica Young is on deck.
Thank you, Canseco. Mr. Chairman. My name is Gay Canseco, and I'm the director of a preschool in South Minneapolis and have worked in childcare for 32 years. The pandemic has been an incredible, difficult time for all of us in childcare, and the lack of support for years had already taken a toll on us. The COVID pandemic caused me and many other leaders in my position to make difficult choices. Many of us went without pay or less pay to keep our centers open. Initially, we struggled to remain open for essential worker families, but even as more of our students are returning, we are still struggling because of decreased student enrollment and thus decreased revenue. Many of our families would love to re-enroll their children, but they cannot because of lost income. Consistent early childcare is essential for healthy development. Recent studies have indicated that a child's self-esteem is already established by age 5. Quality childcare is an absolute necessity for children and their families to navigate their first school experience successfully. Even before the pandemic, and especially now, because of low funding, there are very few centers with adequately trained and paid staff. Ironically, the cost of quality care is very expensive, putting it out of reach for many families. This has had a negative effect on the entire community. This is especially true in low-income areas. The pandemic has only aggravated the situation. Many early childhood educators lost their jobs because schools closed. This has caused a vacuum of quality schools and prevented many families from returning to work, thus decreasing tax revenue. This is why we support the governor's budget, specifically his proposal to implement a tax code where all Minnesotans pay their fair share, including the top 1% in corporations. We have provided care for years under diverse conditions. It's time for the state and Senate to care for us by supporting the governor's budget. The funds that his proposal will provide will make the difference between a struggling, broken system to a system where children, parents, and teachers and providers will be supported and respected by the state. These funds will make quality childcare accessible to all families. We support the governor's budget. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Canseco. Any questions? All right, hearing none, we'll move next to Jessica Young, and on deck is Angela Larson. Ms. Young, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Marquardt and committee members. My name is Jessica Young, and I am a policy and advocacy manager at the Medical Alley Association. We are the cross-sector healthcare association in Minnesota that supports and advances Medical Alley's global leadership in health, innovation, and care. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today on House File 991. We want to thank the bill author for the inclusion of $7 million for the Angel Tax Credit. This program is critical in continuing to grow our startup ecosystem. Our association supports tax policy that encourages job growth and continues to elevate Minnesota as a national leader in healthcare innovation. We are concerned, however, that generally this bill inhibits rather than advances Medical Alley's global leadership in health, innovation, and care. It will put healthcare organizations located here at a disadvantage and will have a negative impact on how our state is viewed for expansions and relocations. To be brief, the significant changes made to both corporate and individual income taxes harm competition, and the other changes in the bill do little to offset this. Additionally, modification to the data center provision is a major concern of our association. A number of prominent Minnesota companies have made investments in data centers with assurance from the state of a 20-year tax exemption. Modifying a tax incentive retroactively sends the wrong message to other companies that are looking to come to Minnesota. I appreciate having the opportunity to share our thoughts on House File 991, and we look forward to ongoing conversations around balancing the state's budget and helping our state recover from the effects of the COVID-19 pandemic. Thank you very much.
Ms. Young, thank you so much for your testimony. Is there any questions? Representative Sandell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry I missed raising my hand, but I would like to ask the representative from Better Business Bureau, or rather Minnesota Business Partnership, a quick question if she's still available, please.
Ms. Larson, I don't know. Yeah, that's one thing with, I think, the Zoom meetings. You're going to have to catch people right on time. So maybe do that offline if you can, Representative Sandell.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry.
Because, in fact, I will tell you that we're kind of rolling people in on this because there's so many. So we don't. So we're kind of kicking people out, too, as we go. Not literally, of course, but just to kind of make things work. So
no, I
that's
understand.
Why she's probably not on.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Next, we have Angela Larson and then Melissa Heising on deck. So, Ms. Larson, please proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members, and thank you for allowing me the opportunity to testify. My name is Angela Larson, and I'm the Family Services Director for United Community Action Partnership, and my main office is in Marshall. We at UCAP have operated a free tax prep program for low-income individuals and families for the last 14 years and have sites in six locations in southwest Minnesota. Through that work, I've been able to see the difference that credits like the Working Family Tax Credit have made in the lives of low-income Minnesotans. Like the Federal Earned Income Tax Credit, the Working Family Credit is only available to people who are working. So it encourages people to work by helping them cover things like paying for childcare or their transportation to get to work, or sometimes new work boots or tools required for their position. These valuable credits will be especially important now as people will be recovering physically and financially from COVID-19. Many working families look forward to tax time because it can help them get caught up with things that they may have fallen behind on or take care of issues that they have been putting on the back burner. For example, one young woman found out that she was going to be getting just over $1,000 in a tax refund, and she cried because she was finally going to be able to get a water pump put in her vehicle and she could quit walking to work in the winter. A single dad shared recently with us that he was going to be able to buy a new bed for his son. Most often, though, we hear about how people will be able to get caught up on their bills and just be able to stop worrying so much. The expansion of the Working Family Credit will make a real difference in the lives of the people who are in the greatest need. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Larson. Any questions for Ms. Larson? All right. Thank you. Next, Melissa Heising and Eric Bernstein will be on deck.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair
and
members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to testify. My name is Melissa Heising, and I'm Legislative Director for the Minnesota AFL-CIO, the state labor federation of more than 1,000 local unions who represent more than 300,000 working people throughout Minnesota. We support the governor's proposals to raise revenue from the wealthiest Minnesotans and most profitable corporations to meet Minnesotans' needs while providing tax benefits to low and moderate income Minnesotans. The COVID-19 pandemic that caused the budget deficit exacerbated racial and economic disparities that existed before the pandemic. Essential workers and communities of color have shouldered the greatest burden of the public health and economic impacts of these crises. The recession has been unequal. We see those at the top increasing their wealth while Minnesotans who were already struggling are being left further behind. To solve our budget deficit and make investments so working Minnesotans can recover and thrive, we support a new fifth-tier income tax on the wealthiest Minnesotans, raising the estate tax on the wealthiest estates, increasing the working family credit for low and moderate income Minnesotans, taxing corporations on repatriated foreign income, increasing the tax on corporate profits, raising taxes on capital gains and dividend income on the wealthiest investors. I want to remind committee members that the 2017 federal tax bill gave large corporations massive permanent tax cuts, and many have been thriving during this crisis. A recent Washington Post analysis of the 50 most valuable publicly traded U.S. companies found that during the first 6 months of the pandemic, 45 of the 50 turned a profit. Combined, they distributed more than $240 billion to shareholders. All 50 spent far more paying out investors than they spent on COVID relief, and 27 of the 50 laid off a combined 100,000 workers. Workers have suffered and sacrificed the most during this pandemic, while the wealthiest and big corporations have gotten richer. Those who have prospered during these difficult times. To help us not just recover, but rebuild and pay more in taxes to fund Minnesotans' needs. Thank you for your time, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Heising, thank you so much. Any questions? All right, we're going to move to Eric Bernstein, and then we have Barta Wahi on deck. Mr. Bernstein.
Chairman Marquardt, members of the committee, thank you for having me. My name is Eric Bernstein, and I am the policy director at We Make Minnesota, which is a pro-revenue coalition of labor and community groups from across the state. I am here today to speak in support of Governor Walz's proposed budget. The tax increases included in the proposal would take a small share of earnings from profitable corporations and the wealthiest Minnesotans and apply it to some of our most pressing and productive public investment priorities. In particular, the proposal to apply a surcharge to capital income over $500,000 would target the extremely wealthy who have benefited from a skyrocketing stock market while regular Minnesotans muddle through a trying recession. These policies are pro-growth, pro-equity, and well-justified by both Minnesota's budget history and sound economic reasoning, but their individual merits undersell the wisdom and necessity of the governor's overall proposal. A state budget is a reinvestment. Contrary to some statements made today, tax dollars raised and spent by the state of Minnesota are not wasted, but put directly back into the economy to fund the roads, schools, and countless other collective needs that make that economy possible. And yet, as a country and as a state, we are reinvesting less and less each year while the demands of a modern economy intensify. The United States now reinvests a smaller share of its economy than any other developed nation. More recently, we have also become the only major economic power to scale back our public investments, allowing our infrastructure to degrade and our standard of life to fall behind that of our peers. Divestment is happening here, too. As a share of income, Minnesota's taxes and total revenues have dropped by 10 to 20% since the 1990s. If Minnesota's effective tax rates remained at their mid-90s levels, Governor Walz and the legislature would have an additional $12 to $15 billion to invest in our state's priorities this biennium. Will we fund childcare or local government aid, transit or rural broadband? In practice, we are choosing the retained earnings of the richest Minnesotans over all of these things. Whatever the public return on the corporate profits and the rich getting richer, they pale in comparison to direct investment in our immediate needs. The truth is that Minnesota's budget has not grown too large, but too slowly. I urge you all to think of the needs of your communities and remember—
Mr. Bernstein, 2 minutes.
You got it. I urge you all to think of the needs of your communities and remember that we have the means to fulfill those needs if only we can find the will to do so. Thank you.
Mr. Bernstein, thank you so much. Any questions? Next up, we have Barta Wahi and then Tim Gross on deck. Please proceed and welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Marquardt and members of the committee. My name is Barta Wahi and I am the Executive Director of the Children's Defense Fund of Minnesota. I am delighted to be talking to you today about the connection between tax policy and child and youth well-being and express our support for the governor's balanced approach to investments and revenue, an approach that positions Minnesota's children, youth, and families for success. Both before and during the COVID-19 pandemic, while some Minnesota families prospered, others have struggled. Issues like geographic, economic, and racial inequities have created barriers for children and youth prior to the pandemic, and these have only been exacerbated during this time. The state's budget, both the revenue and investment sides of the ledger, are a reflection of what we value most. The value we place on children, youth, and families is evident in our tax system. Our budget should be one that reflects core Minnesota values of fairness and support. We need the necessary revenue for child and youth-focused investments to help all children have healthy births and bond with parents and caregivers, particularly in the first years of life, to ensure children, youth, and families have the economic support they need to meet basic needs and, dare I say it, thrive. To help Minnesota children and youth recenter academically and socially, emotionally, particularly after this year of isolation. And finally, to address the barriers I referenced before that have left children in greater Minnesota, children in living in low-income households, and children of color marginalized. We think the governor's approach, calling on the support from those who have prospered the most, reflect these values. I also want to highlight our support of the Working Family Credit. It is a proven policy critical to the economic stability of families. Expanding it makes sense both now and in the long term because we know even small increases in income can have an important positive impact on children and heading off adverse childhood experiences like hunger, homelessness, and family stress. We think that many families have been hit hard during the economic and health impacts of COVID. Increased expansion of revenue and the working family credit can really help to ensure that children have what they need to thrive and that our values are aligned in our tax policy.
Thank you very much. Any questions? All right. First of all, I want to announce too, Representative Herr joined us a while ago. I didn't announce it at that time. So Representative Herr is here also. Tim Gross is next, and then Jonathan Rose on deck. Mr. Gross.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Tim Gross. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Petroleum Marketers Association. Our 500 business members own and operate the majority of convenience stores found across Minnesota. We oppose the increase in the tobacco excise tax for cigarettes and moist snuff due to the surge of state cross-border sales that will take place. The result will bring great harm to many retailers in Minnesota. With the proposed increase in the tobacco excise tax, the differences in cigarette carton costs compared to our neighboring states would be Wisconsin cartons $15.20 less, Iowa cartons $26.80 less, South Dakota $25.10 less, and in North Dakota $36 less. Let me share my own experience as a retailer in Duluth. Back in 2013, when the last tobacco tax increase took place, we operated 10 convenience stores, 9 in Duluth and 1 in Superior, Wisconsin. After the tax increased, our 9 Minnesota stores lost between 15 and 20% of the tobacco sales. But our one store in Superior, Wisconsin had increased tobacco sales, equaling the total losses of our 9 stores in Minnesota. So the end results of the 2013 tobacco excise tax increase was, one, sales moved from Minnesota retailers across state lines, hurting many Minnesota retailers. Two, little or no health benefit was experienced due to the cross-border traffic. Consumers in Minnesota still purchase the same amount of tobacco products. Three, the state of Minnesota lost a significant amount of tobacco excise tax due to shift the sale to Wisconsin. With another proposed increase in tax, these end results will be magnified again in Duluth and many other state border cities and markets. To recap, the proposed increase in tobacco excise tax will, one, decrease the forecasted collections of excise tax in Minnesota. Two, public health will not benefit. Consumers will be changing their buying habits, but not their consumption. And finally, three, cross-border sales will create great harm to many retailers across the state. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for your time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Gross. Any questions? All right, we're going to move next to Jonathan Rose, and Anna Hottinger is on deck. Mr. Rose, welcome to the committee. Oh, Mr. Rose, we can't hear you. So let's do this, let's go to the next testifier. Mr. Rose will come back to you, if that's okay. So if we can go to Anna Hottinger, and then we'll come back to Mr. Rose. Ms. Hottinger, welcome to the committee. Please begin your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Marquette and members. My name is Anna Grace Hottinger, and I am a senior in high school in Shoreview. I'm an advocate for tobacco prevention and have worked on many local campaigns, including Tobacco 21 and flavor policies. I'm a youth ambassador for the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids and an intern at the Association for Non-Smokers. First, let me thank Governor Walz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan for putting forward bold tobacco changes in their budget. In addition to supporting the proposed tobacco, cigarette and e-cigarette tax increases, I would also like to see an increased investment and dedication to youth prevention. The last time Minnesota increased the cigarette tax, thousands of people quit smoking. Unfortunately, over the last few years, a whole new wave of nicotine and tobacco addiction has emerged, with young people vaping. In 2019, more than 1 in 4 11th graders were using e-cigarettes. A lot of my friends, classmates, and even most of my siblings are being drawn to tobacco addiction with high-tech, discreet, fun-flavored e-cigarettes. The legislature should use all the tools available to prevent the next generation from addiction and to help people quit. An extensive approach includes raising the price of tobacco products, investing in youth prevention, and ending the sale of all flavored products. the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network, and the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids estimate that a $1 per pack increase would lead to a major health gains here in Minnesota. They estimate that 8,800 fewer young people would become adult smokers, and 16,200 adult smokers would quit. And we'd save more than $530 million in long-term health savings. Even the tobacco industry acknowledges that raising tobacco taxes reduces smoking, which is why they fight so hard to oppose them. I encourage you to support this tax change to save lives and to save dollars. Thank you.
Ms. Hunter, thank you so much. Any questions? Thank you. Mr. Rose, we'll go back to you.
Can you hear me now?
We can. Welcome to the committee.
And thank you very
much.
By
the way, Mike Smith is on deck. So go ahead, Mr. Rose. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Chairman McQuart and committee members for giving me this opportunity to testify today. My name is Dr. Jonathan Rose from Minnesotans for Smoke-Free Generation. I am a tobacco and public health researcher, and I'm also the proud grandfather of five teenage grandsons. On the subject of tobacco and addiction, an abundance of data shows very clearly that over 70% of adults that are addicted to commercial tobacco start smoking in their teens. Also, an abundance of evidence shows that big tobacco companies have laser-targeted our youth, especially youth in the African and African-American communities, such as my grandchildren, and youth within American Indian, Asian American, Latino, and LGBTQ communities using attractive flavors and low prices. Big tobacco uses these marketing strategies to trap our youth into becoming lifelong smokers, and this is how my adult son became a tobacco addict. Furthermore, an abundance of data on tobacco pricing shows a significant correlation between higher tobacco prices and reductions in youth tobacco use. Higher prices are an effective way to reduce and prevent youth from smoking. Black people and people from communities of color are the most likely to die from tobacco-enabled heart disease. Therefore, to prevent my grandchildren and their friends from becoming tobacco victims, I support the tax increases on tobacco products proposed in HF 991 and urge you to pair the increases with increased investments in youth prevention, cessation, and continued research. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Rose. Any questions? All right. We'll move to Mike Smith, and then on deck is Cap O'Rourke. Mr. Smith. I think you're muted still, Mr. Smith. You're still muted.
Mr. Chairman, can you hear me now?
We can. Welcome to the committee.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Mike Smith. I'm a second-generation owner of Granite City Jobbing, a family wholesale business located in St. Cloud. The governor's proposed tax increase on cigarettes, moist snuff, and electronic cigarettes will place an even larger financial burden on the wholesale distributors and on our retail accounts. For background purposes, a wholesaler is licensed by the Department of Revenue and has to purchase special stamps sold in advance by the department for wholesalers to affix to each pack of cigarettes. The cost for each stamp is $3.67, which includes $3.04 for the cigarette tax and 63 cents for the cigarette sales tax. The law requires wholesalers to pay the retail sales tax on cigarettes in advance as part of the cigarette stamp cost. That means our company and every wholesaler has to have a line of credit with a bank because of the cost of buying the cigarette stamps is so high. That is, we have to borrow the money to pay the tax in advance. The governor wants to raise the cigarette tax by another dollar to become $4.04 a pack. That means our lines of credit are going to be increased substantially to cover the higher taxes. This is a huge financial burden on the wholesalers. Collectively, all wholesalers collect and remit $1.1 billion every biennium in cigarette and tobacco excise taxes. And the governor wants to raise another $139 million with his tax increases. Neither the wholesalers nor the retailers are made of money. There is a limit to how high these taxes can be increased, and we are at that limit. The COVID pandemic has resulted in our retail accounts losing up to 45% of their gasoline sales because people are working from home, and up to 20% of in-store sales, which includes a lot of tobacco. We have all worked very hard to stay in business during these difficult times. Now is not the time to raise taxes. The state has a rainy day budget fund for covering these deficits. Well, it's kind of pouring outside, and I urge you to use the surplus fund instead of raising taxes. I thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you very much, Mr. Smith. Next, we have Cap O'Rourke and then Guy Bentley. Mr. O'Rourke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Cap O'Rourke, and I'm here on behalf of the Midwest Vapor Coalition. We represent retailers and manufacturers of vapor products and e-cigarettes. We are here in opposition to the governor's proposed tax on these products, both the 95% tax on devices and the additional 30% tax at register. If this were to be imposed, I remember the governor said that this is a moral document and creating incentives. The problem is, if this were to be imposed, this would be taxing the products that have the lowest amount of nicotine, the absolute highest. And it would create an incentive for those users to use high nicotine vapor products, or even worse, be using traditional tobacco products, which we know kills over 1,000 people a day. These products, for example, this product currently retails, this is just a device, this currently retails for $35. With the compounding impact of the 95% and the 30%, this product would end up retailing for over $65. That's before you have any liquid. These prices are already at a threshold that is out of the average youth and young people. They have a high price entry point, but over the long term, our adult users do save money. Taxing these products in this manner would cost our adult users and make them have the hard decision to go to high nicotine products or back to smoking. Please oppose these taxes. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. O'Rourke. Next, we'll have Guy Bentley. And if you do have questions, just to kind of, we're sitting good with time, but we're getting close. If you do have questions, just have your hand raised ahead of time. Otherwise, I'll just move to the next testifier. I haven't seen any hands raised yet, but Mr. Bentley will be next, and then Thomas Bryant. So, Mr. Bentley.
Chair, members of the committee, thank you so much for the opportunity to speak to you today. My name is Guy Bentley. I'm Director of Consumer Freedom at the Reason Foundation. We're a nonprofit, nonpartisan think tank. I'd like to speak about the vapor and tobacco product excise taxes being proposed in the budget. Minnesota was the first state in the nation to impose an e-cigarette tax. It remains one of the highest, and we have had some analysis of the effect of that tax. A study that was released last year showed that after Minnesota introduced that tax, 32,400 fewer smokers quit because of the tax. And the reason that is because e-cigarettes are substitutes, not complements to traditional cigarettes, and are a far less harmful way of consuming nicotine. So whenever you raise e-cigarette taxes, that is fewer people switching away from combustible cigarettes, which is the most dangerous form of tobacco use. Secondly, I'd like to turn your attention to the part of the bill where it talks about heated tobacco products. Not everyone might know what these are. There's only one heated tobacco product that's been authorized for sale in the United States, and it's currently not sold at any store in Minnesota, so any tax increase on it will not raise any revenue anyway. But this product is called IQOS, and the Food and Drug Administration has granted what it calls a modified risk order to this product. And what that means is the FDA has evaluated the science around that product and concluded that IQOS, quote, significantly reduces the production of harmful and potentially harmful chemicals. And I quote, switching completely from conventional cigarettes to the IQOS system significantly reduces your body's exposure to harmful or potentially harmful chemicals. So levying a large tax on a product that the Food and Drug Administration has authorized to market as less toxic than combustible cigarettes would not be a great move for public health. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bentley. Next, we have Thomas Bryant and then Lance Klatt. Mr. Bryant.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Tom Bryant, and I represent the Minnesota Wholesale Marketers Association. The association's members sell products to retail stores. The tax increases on cigarettes, moist snuff, and electronic cigarettes in House File 991 would result in Minnesota being ranked as the fourth highest cigarette tax nationwide, the second highest tax on moist snuff, and the highest tax on electronic cigarettes of all the states. At the same time, Minnesota is currently ranked as the fifth highest state for cigarette smuggling, and a $1 per pack increase would make current cigarette smuggling and cross-border purchases even worse. The Mackinac Center for Public Policy Study on Cigarette Smuggling concludes that 36% of all cigarettes smoked in Minnesota are obtained from sources outside the state. The budget projects that these tax increases will raise $139 million, but the Department of Revenue's explanation in the documents provided by the committee of the tax increases does not make any reference to the smuggling and cross-border impact on tax collections. Were the smuggling and cross-border factors taken into account? We simply don't know. And why does Minnesota have such a high rate of cigarette smuggling? Because of the difference in cigarette tax rates. If the $1 cigarette tax rate is enacted, Minnesotans would save $46 on a carton of cigarettes bought in North Dakota, $35 in South Dakota, $37 in Iowa, and $25 in Wisconsin. These different tax rates put wholesalers and their Minnesota retail accounts at a severe competitive disadvantage to retailers in other states. During the COVID pandemic, retail sales of gas and in-store products have declined significantly because people are working from home. At the same time, our wholesalers and retail accounts have worked very hard to remain open, but the proposed tax increases carry a heavy burden. The financial burden could lead to employee layoffs and store closures because Minnesota's ranking at or near the top of cigarette and tobacco tax rates would magnify the illicit market, smuggling, and cross-border purchases. We urge you to not increase taxes on wholesalers, retailers, and consumers. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bryant. Next is Mr. Klatt, and then Monty Williams. Mr. Klatt, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Name is Lance Klatt, Executive Director of the Minnesota Service Station and Community Store Association. My organization represents nearly 400 petroleum and repair auto repair retailers in the state of Minnesota. A large concern for my members is the governor's proposal to raise state cigarette and moist snuff taxes by 33% and his proposal for a new tax on electronic cigarettes. Minnesota currently has the ninth highest cigarette tax in the country at $3.04 a pack. The governor's proposal further penalizes retailers and consumers by raising the tax another dollar per pack. At $4.04 per pack, Minnesota's cigarette tax rate would move to the fourth highest in the nation. Minnesota customers will be able to save a significant amount on a carton of cigarettes by purchasing them in neighboring states, such as Mr. Gross and Mr. Bryant, as just previously mentioned. The savings on a carton of cigarettes would be $36 in North Dakota, $25.10 in South Dakota, $26.80 in Iowa, and $15.20 in Wisconsin. Minnesota retailers do their part every day in preventing the sale of tobacco to the youth. Minnesota retailers consistently lead the nation in successfully completed compliance checks. Our members employ thousands of Minnesotans. We bear incredible burdens and costs to collect tobacco, fuel, and sales taxes. Most of our transactions are paid by credit cards. We must pay the credit card fees for those transactions, including credit card fees on the millions of dollars we collect in excise and sales tax for our great state. We get no recognition for being one of the largest tax collectors for the state of Minnesota. The proposed tax increases will result in my members paying millions more to credit card companies in transaction fees. Burdening my members and their customers with the fourth highest cigarette tax in the country will cost jobs and likely force stores to close, especially stores near our state's borders, as Mr. Gross has talked about. What my members need now is support, tax relief, and less regulations and mandates. My members do not deserve higher taxes that penalize them and their customers. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and the members.
Mr. Klatt, thank you so much. We now have Monty Williams, and then Karen Gerlach is on deck. Mr. Williams.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. My name is Monty Williams, and I'm offering testimony to the committee today on behalf of Altria and its affiliates, Philip Morris USA, John Middleton, and U.S. Smokeless Tobacco. My comments and opinions are based on 30 years with the California Board of Equalization, where I held the position of Chief of Excise Taxes and also Chief of Criminal Investigations. I have over 20 years' experience at the state level in Tobacco Tax Enforcement Administration. I've also served at the Federation of Tax Administrators Tobacco Tax Section. I'm going to just cover one item today in the interest, and it's been brought up before, and that's the issue of cross-border smuggling of tobacco products. And my comments will focus basically on cigarettes, but they also apply to other tobacco products and vapor products. The same things will apply to those. If this proposal is adopted, as been pointed out, Minnesota's cigarette tax will be $3.60 higher than North Dakota, $2.51 higher than South Dakota, and $1.52 higher than Wisconsin. This is a significant amount of money per pack, but when you think about a carton of 10 packs and then a case of 50 cartons, it's a lot of money, and it adds up quick. And based on my experience, this kind of a tax differential will cause adult consumers to modify their behavior and look for cheaper sources of cigarettes and also change their attitude about paying taxes. It may begin with casual smuggling, which I believe you're having right now because of your tax rate. But to put it in a better perspective, a 20-foot U-Haul truck that went to North Dakota and bought tax-paid cigarettes in North Dakota, which has no stamp, I might point out, and brought it back into Minnesota would have an $850,000 tax advantage in Minnesota. A Ford Taurus, in the trunk of a Ford Taurus, you could have a tax advantage of $16,000. That's significant money and gets people to move into this area. And as was pointed out, the Mackinac Center points out that already 36% of your consumed tobacco in Minnesota is not purchased in Minnesota. And I see no language in the bill to address this kind of enforcement issue. Okay, I thank you very much for your time here, and I'd be happy to try to answer any questions if anyone has them. Thank you.
Mr. Williams, thank you so much. Next up is Ms. Gerlach, and then Gregory Conley is on deck. Ms. Gerlach, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Dr. Karen Gerlach. I'm testifying today in opposition to the portion of the bill of House File 991 that would increase Minnesota's already nation-leading tax on electronic nicotine vapor products. I offer my testimony as a current consultant to Reynolds American, and I also bring 25 years of experience in the public health tobacco control field, including work with the National Cancer Institute, the CDC's Office on Smoking and Health, and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. My testimony today reflects my views only and is based in my wide experience in tobacco control. The FDA has well recognized that there is a continuum of risk across tobacco and nicotine containing products, and that by far cigarettes are the most harmful. Public health researchers estimate that e-cigarettes are 90 to 95% less harmful than cigarettes. The proposed tax increase would more than double Minnesota's tax on e-cigarettes. And despite the fact that the bill also raises the cigarette tax, the result would still be that a pack of cigarettes would be nearly 50 cents lower than an e-cigarette cartridge. This creates a significant financial disincentive for Minnesota smokers to switch from the highest risk tobacco product to those that are significantly less harmful. And in a worst case scenario, Minnesota's former smokers who've already successfully switched to these lower risk products would have a financial incentive to return to cigarette smoking. I don't believe that this is your intent with this bill. A 2020 study published by the National Bureau of Economic Research and funded by the National Institutes of Health found that for each e-cigarette cartridge not purchased as a result of an increase in the e-cigarette tax, more than six packs of cigarettes are purchased. Your taxing authority can be employed to encourage Minnesota smokers to switch to lower risk products, which would not only decrease the state's smoking rate, but also the associated health care and societal costs that result.
Dr. Gerlach, that's 2 minutes. If you could finish the sentence there.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you very much, Dr. Gerlach. Next up is Gregory Conley, and then last testifier, Molly Moylanen. So, Mr. Conley.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Gregory Conley. I am the president of a nonprofit advocacy group called the American Vaping Association, and we want to encourage you to think a little harder about the e-cigarette tax as well as the OTP tax increase in HF 911. There are still 630,000 adult smokers in Minnesota, and regressive tax increases are not going to help them. And these taxes are particularly odious when their end effect is discouraging adult smokers from quitting combustible products. This is especially true now that we are entering a new world where the only newly marketed tobacco derived 5 nicotine products will be ones that the FDA designates as, quote, appropriate for the protection of public health after thorough scientific examinations of the products. This is a new world where you have people who have worked in public health for years, tobacco control for years, who would never dream of working in a for or with a tobacco or nicotine company, and they are coming and they are seeing the potential of these products. Please pay attention to the research cited by Guy Bentley from the National Bureau of Economic Research. It is damning of Minnesota's current e-cigarette tax. I also want to implore you to do a fiscal note that takes into consideration passage of HF 904, the flavor ban bill. This would be a double whammy. You have a new dollar tax on the cigarette category. Meanwhile, you're eliminating huge portions of the tobacco market. About 70% of your current sales are going to end up going to neighboring states, and you're going to have small businesses, vapor stores that market to adult smokers and vapors. They'll go out of business as well. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify. I'm glad to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Connolly. Appreciate that. And our final testifier, Molly Moylanen. So, Ms. Moylanen, welcome to the committee, and please proceed.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Molly Moylanen, and I am Vice President of Clearway, Minnesota. Clearway was created as a limited-life, independent nonprofit working to reduce commercial tobacco use in our state, and we will sunset at the end of this year. We support increasing tobacco prices because they are the top driver of smoking declines. Since 1993, 53% of smoking reductions in Minnesota have come from price increases alone. Price increases inspire current smokers to quit and prevent new users from ever starting. These results and the health benefits that accompany lower incidence of smoking are realized most in groups that historically smoke at higher rates. I want to make a few points about today's bill. First, this bill could have an even greater health impact if a fraction of the revenue was dedicated to cessation and prevention. Last year, Minnesota collected nearly $760 million in tobacco taxes and settlement fees, but only 1% of that money is used for tobacco control. Please consider directing more tobacco revenue to health as you weigh various proposals this year. Second, as proposed, taxing e-cigarette devices, regardless if they are sold with or without the nicotine solution, is a good idea that we support because it keeps our tax code in line with the evolving e-cigarette industry. We are ready to work with the department on the specific language to reflect best practices from other states that have already done this. Now, one concern raised today by Big Tobacco is the potential for an increase in illicit sales. I want to underscore that this is a common and exaggerated tobacco industry claim to discourage decision makers from taking meaningful action. Minnesota's cigarette tax stamp system is very good. See, the industry knows what we know. Higher prices discourage smoking, which compromises their profits. And that's the bottom line. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I want to thank you. All the testifiers, and I really want to thank all the testifiers for adding to this discussion and also for staying on time. This was very, very good. Chair Davids.
Well, thank you, Chair Marquardt. And in my experience as a former tax chair carrying Governor Dayton's budget proposals, I was always glad when this committee was about to wrap up from this hearing. And my good friend, Governor Dayton, but I have a question for Mr. Williams. And my question is, how many Minnesotans make too much money for the working family credit, but too little to benefit from the rate bracket increase?
Mr. Williams, did you catch that question?
Chair Marquardt and Representative Davids, I did some preliminary modeling on this question at the request of some members earlier, and I think I found about 411,000 returns or so that were below the first-year black bracket threshold, but above the point at which the working family credit would phase out.
Mr. Williams,
well, thank you. Yes, I'm sorry.
I didn't quite say that again. Would you 411,000 that?
Chair Marquardt and Representative Davids, there's about 411,000 returns that did not benefit from the increases in the working family credit. So their incomes were too high to benefit from the working family credit increases, but not quite high enough to benefit to pay into the second tier of the tax and benefit from the changes in the second tier bracket threshold.
Very good. Thank you. Chair Davids.
Well, I guess the theme for today is basically false hope. I mean, we look at the C-Corps, 97.2% of the C-Corps in Minnesota make less than $1 million a year. So it's not these big rich folks we're going after. But, you know, to say that we're just raising taxes on the top 1% or 0.7, that's absolutely not true. Now, if you say income taxes, then it'd be a true statement. But I'm hearing from many people that there's, you know, only the top 1% are getting hit. There are massive tax increases, $1.9 billion in tax increases, most of it going on the poor. And Mr. Chairman, I refuse to increase taxes on the poor. I won't do that. Now, this hearing today, of course, provides a lot of false hope because this bill, number one, it's not balanced. Number two, it's not going anywhere. But I do thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the bill hearing. And after today, I was always kind of relieved a day like this that now we can actually get to work on putting a deal together. So thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the hearing.
Thank you very much. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If the testifier from Clearway is still available, I had a quick question for her.
Ms. Moylanen, I don't know, and I'm sorry, Representative Garofalo, I saw your hand go up and I thought it was comments towards the end, so I don't know if she's on. Ms. Moylanen, I'm sorry, Representative Garofalo, she is not on. So
I'll take my question with them offline. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. So, well, thank you, members, so much. This is the first step in the budget. And, you know, I do commend Governor Walz. He recognizes that we are in very challenging times, both economically, health-wise, and he knows that we have to do something. We've got to help people, businesses around the state. And that's going to take an investment. And he's put out his plan on how he plans to pay for it. And it will be part of the discussion as we move forward. But I do appreciate all the testifiers and the comments. And next week on Tuesday, we're hearing two bills, Representative Baker's bill that would exempt sales taxes on capital expenditures for restaurants. And then also Representative Chair Joachim's bill on historic rehabilitation. So we've got some interesting bills. And then Wednesday, no meeting. And then Thursday, we've got some bills that we have on the agenda. So members, have a nice rest of the week. Thank you for your work this week. And with that, we are adjourned.